Accession number 11214, rule 10.
Colonel Jourdain, Reel 10. We were talking about your time in Upper Silesia, 1921 to 22. Now, you were actually staying with the general at Turava. Is that right?
Actually, Allen lived in what was the state office. The general lived in the actual manor, if you like, and he had, I think, either the downstairs part of the flat or the upstairs part, and the family had the converse thing, you see what I mean? The owners were still there, but there was non-fraternization rule.
And who made that rule? Whose decision was it that there should be no fraternization?
Probably the High Commission. You see, it was a High Commission. I think the General was High Commissioner as well in that particular case. And there was a non-fraternization rule, which of course was honoured considerably more on the breach of the observance, if only because of the girls. And the Taravas, that's the family who lived, did I say upstairs or downstairs? I can't remember. Upstairs, I think, had nothing to do, more or less, apart from saying good morning and that kind of thing, with the occupants. I mean, in the military sense. And there was no friction, but certain taboos had to be observed, I suppose. The curious thing was that when the Graf's mother died at a great age, there was a sort of dies non, where this non-fraternization rule completely disappeared for 24 hours. And that was interesting, because the general himself went off to Dresden or somewhere to keep out of the way, and he left the ANQMG and myself to represent the British army there in plain clothes. And we went to the funeral in plain clothes. I had to go into our home and buy myself a reach-me-down German suit to do it. And that was quite interesting, because we behaved perfectly normal with the boys of the family and that kind of thing for 24 hours. And at the end of the 24 hours, everybody did a sort of glorious as you were. The boys went back to the Poles somewhere in Upper Silesia, and we went back to our normal role as policemen. That was a curious facet, I think. Just lasted 24 hours, but it was quite good fun.
What about the besides this family, the Taravas, you know, that yeah. you were staying with, what about the other Germans in the area?
Well, it was an ordinary village, rather like a village here, and I and this chap, A.J. Allen, fed in a workman's cottage where we had very good food. I may say we really liked it. Not in the place we lived in the estate office and worked in the estate office, not in the Schloss itself, and we fed in this workman's cottage, which is very good food. And we've got ducklings and that sort of thing. And that worked out very well. But theoretically, there was a sort of non-fraternization rule on. And what you did was really only to say good morning to people and be civil with them. But there wasn't... Language, of course, had something to do with it. But there was not much fraternization in the ordinary sense of the word between the occupying people and the locals. But there was no friction. And, of course, there were various attachments to girls and so on, most respectable. And a very pleasant life was had, because it was like living in a vast area like that with forests all round. And the general had two horses, which he did not ride, and I and this other chap who was with me had the horses at our disposal. And that was very nice, because we could ride for miles round in the forests and so on. And there's that bit in one of the things I wrote about climbing up to the top of a tree and finding an old man up there who'd been in Paris in 1870 and cut me down to size when I was talking big. And said, young man, there'll always be wars, and I was in Paris in 1870, which made me retreat down the tree fairly quickly. You know, that kind of thing. It was not comic opera exactly, but it was, one could have written quite good sketches about it if one had the ability to write a bit better.
Did you have any troops with you, a sort of escort, you know,
there was
in
a guard,
village?
Yes, that's true. There was a guard, in the ordinary sense of the word, of about two NCOs and 10 men or something of that sort, on the Schloss to represent the British Empire and that. And they had sentry boxes outside the big house doors and a couple of sentries there. And that, of course, was quite amusing because, naturally, the few troops, about a dozen of them, wanted to get off with the girls and did. And the relationships were quite nice. The only, I think it's in probably in one of those stories, where a soldier either boxed the ears of a man, he did something like that, nothing very serious, and the man came up to me and explained in considerable detail that he had been a warrant officer in the German army, and you could not have soldiers of the British army bashing warrant officers, or even ex-warrant officers of the German army. I had to point out to him he was an ex-warrant officer, but it didn't go down very well. Anyway, it was that sort of comic opera business going on most of the time. And as I say, our work was mostly done at night, and we were riding around the place and going into Oppeln and occasionally to Berlin.
Now, what was your work? You were the two
we were doing cipher work. There was a great deal of cipher traffic. All the telegrams from the Upper Silesian force to the War Office and so on had to go in cipher. And
and they went from where the general was rather than the headquarters.
He did most of that stuff, and that's why we were there, you see, because rather than the headquarters. Of course, it was a curious thing that he did not want to be sitting in Gross Straits with the rest of his staff. He had his family out there, too. I mean, Lady Hennecke was there, and two boys who were at school, they came out for their holidays, because we were there quite a long time.
So what was the routine of your work on an evening? I mean,
roughly speaking, working from about, say, 9 till 12 at night. And odd things might crop up in the daytime. One of us would normally be about.
And the codes you were using were similar to the ones you described when you were in Ireland, were they?
Yes, I think so. I think the usual sort of thing. A book like one of those dictionaries there was as a sort of dictionary, which gave, I think, five figure numbers for words. And then there was something added to it for the code for the day, that kind of principle. I did one rather bright thing. I think it may have been in one of those so-called articles. We sent a detachment to a place called Sopron in Hungary, and I was told to give them a cipher, a fairly simple one, to work back to us from Hungary to there. And they did just that. They sent several telegrams, not one of which I could decipher. And it took me about a week or a fortnight or something to find out why. And the reason was that they handed their telegrams into a civil post office. There wasn't anything else to hand them into. And the civil post office took anything that was meant to be a 7 as a 1, because, of course, Continental put a bar on the 7s. And they were not putting bars on the 7s. And, of course, the cipher got all mucked up because of that. And it took me quite a long time to find that out. It's a curious thing to happen. But that's exactly what it was. There were no bars on the 7. The telegrams were handed into what was really a civil post office, and they transmitted them all as ones.
Did you find it easy to decode once you...
Oh, yes. I think so. For some odd reason, I'd had quite a lot of experience of that racket, if you like. And when I first started, I was put in the War Office, I think, for a month or something like that. And you were given telegrams which had got mistakes in them to try and decipher, which was quite good training, through numbers being wrongly transmitted by the post office or whoever it was. And you had to guess, to a certain extent, what the numbers should have been and so on, and you found you could do it.
That's
a long time ago now.
Was there any sort of trying to break anybody else's codes? Because there'd be other signals.
We were no part of the Secret Service. I was in that later on, but... So we had no contra-spionage stuff going on there at all. And I don't think we had any MI6 people there.
So it was purely British telegrams you were dealing with. You wouldn't
attempt to decode anything else? No, no. Very limited, of course.
And was that the only work you did?
I think so, yes. Apart from the fact that we were considered to be supernumerary ADCs, and if the general went anywhere... A, he had to have an ADC or possibly two in the car. There was one real ADC, and we had to function as that, having been told that the one thing you must do is to feed the old man with chocolate.
You mentioned the chocolate.
I don't mention that. It's quite true.
What about, I know once that you were sent to see the poles about...
yes, about...
Could you tell me about that trip, what it was like?
Well, it's rather vague. I and another chap called Atkinson, I think I made a mistake in the printed article and corrected it later on. Two of us went to see the Polish headquarters and asked them not to commit so many atrocities. There were a fantastic number of atrocities being committed there, and it really shook me as a really quite a very young chap to see the sort of, or see evidence of the kind of atrocities that Europeans could do to each other.
What kind of thing are you
well,
talking about?
Well, the proof was that in shops in Oppeln, they would not show the actual things, but photographs of open coffins with people who'd been absolutely knocked to bits in them, to show the kind of atrocities that one side or the other were committing. It was all very crude. But there's no doubt about it, there was a great number of atrocities being committed. And, of course, one's limited experience in the First War had never shown anybody any atrocities. I mean, the First War was comparatively clean compared with all this.
And was it your view that both sides were engaging in atrocities, or did you feel one side was...
Oh, I think both. And the Germans, of course, tried to make out it was only the Poles, but I'm quite sure that was not the case. But the Germans are pretty brutal.
Now, this visit was to the Poles to give them...
That was to ask them, theoretically, to ask them, presumably at the request of the Germans, because the British on the commission were very much in with the Germans, you know, they would be, and they were, to go and ask the Polish insurgents not to commit so many atrocities. That was what the mission was about. We went and said just that, and they said, oh, have a drink or something like that. And by the way, would you like to take the little... bit of printed paper back with you. I think there's one of them in the month that I had there. And that was, of course, evidence of atrocities being committed by the Germans. In other words, both sides in Eastern Europe of any nation would commit atrocities, I think, at the drop of a hat, which one had not met, of course, during the war itself.
Now, you said that the British Army was perhaps more closely connected with the German part. Where did your own sympathies lie, or did they lie anywhere? Did you?
Oh, I think the language had a lot to do with it. Many Germans spoke English. The British would find it easier to speak a certain amount of German. There was always the Rhine Army business, you see, with a good deal of fraternization going on. And nobody could speak Polish. And the Poles are always given a bad name automatically.
So you shared the general feeling?
Oh, I suppose so.
When you had contacts with the Poles, like this visit, what was your assessment of them, and what kind of an army, if they were an army, were they?
Oh, I think one's immediate impression, correct, you know, these are irregulars. I mean, I can't think of the proper word. They weren't regular soldiers. They were armed militia, if you like to call it, or something of that sort.
Were they uniformed?
No, they're exactly as you see in that photograph. I mean, they're in plain clothes. Those individuals were more scared of me than I was of them.
Could you tell the story on the tape of what happened? I mean, how did you come to see them?
Yes, well, I suppose the story is that I was riding about the place, and possibly dismounting, wandering around, when suddenly I saw some people with rifles. And the people with rifles appeared to be more scared of me than I was of them. And anyway, they came out of the wood without their rifles. And I talked to them in bad German, which is, we just understood each other. Then I said, go back and get your rifles, I'll take a photograph. And that really pleased them. They went back and got their rifles. They were frontline troops of the Polish occupying army, you see. And I took the photograph and went away quite happily, and they went back into the woods quite happily. They were bona fide insurgent troops.
Were they liable to open fire on British troops, Poles? I mean, what was the British position vis-a-vis the Polish occupying
army? It's difficult to realise, you hardly ever saw any of these people. You see, I only saw those people through riding about in woods over there somewhere or other. And it must have been what passed for a front line. And of course, front lines in that part, that sort of operation, were scattered little small units. They weren't lines in any sense, much the same as in North Russia. And they were, in some sort of sense, the outposts of an occupying Polish army.
but they wouldn't open fire. I mean,
no,
they didn't.
Well, I didn't know whether they would or not, but I was armed with a stick. And they, first thing they did was to drop their rifles and run off into the woods. Then I shouted at them something like, made them come out, and they came out without their rifles. And then I asked them to go back and get their rifles.
What about the German forces? Did you come into more contact with them?
No, I didn't personally. They were somewhere up in the direction of Breslau. I mean, not as far away as that. But I did not personally see them at all.
Did you see any signs
of the last minute when, you know, when they were coming in to occupy the place?
Did you see any signs of fighting, or could you hear the fighting?
No, and it was a little bit like North Russia. Sounds carried long distances, but there was never any sounds of artillery bashing away or anything like that. And I think there probably was not.
So you didn't yourself see any signs of the actual atrocities other than these photographs?
No, only the photographs of people in coffins. They weren't not necessarily at the front.
Now, what were the relations? The British weren't the only forces there, were there? There were other Allied forces.
French and Italians.
What were the I mean, you were at the headquarters of Honecker. What were the relationships like between the various Allied forces?
Well, there was virtually no contact between the troops, because wherever the troops were, they were probably some considerable distance from other batches of troops. There was a commission, I mean, that was the government of that part of the world, which was run by, nominally, by a civil commissioner from England, France and Italy. And the English did have an Indian civil servant as their nominal head, but in fact Honecker, the general, was the British member, and the other two certainly had a French general and an Italian general, as who really were the government of Upper Silesia for about 18 months.
And did they visit the general at his headquarters, either at his personal living place or at the...
No, they lived in Opel, and he wore two hats. My general was... both commander-in-chief of the British forces and the British commissioner, because there was an Indian civil service, you know, the type, who was the commissioner, and he went sick and was not replaced. I forgot what his name was now.
I believe there was a garden party once where they...
Oh, yes.
Can you tell me about that?
Well, it was a bright idea on Henniker's part, very soon after we first went in, to get the Allies, mark you, to know each other. So he had a male garden party at the Schloss Groß Strelitz. And somewhere or other, I think in here, there's a photograph, and there's no particular interest to you or anything, of a group of officers, including myself and my uncle, who was commanding the Connaught Rangers at that time, all behaving like officers and gentlemen at a male garden party. And that male garden party was to get the Allies to know each other and meet each other and be friends ever afterwards. And I think it did a certain amount of good. It was simply literally a garden party one afternoon with photographers about and so on.
But after that you didn't see much of the Italians?
No, because geographically they were all a certain distance away and you didn't see much of them.
Right, now how... You explained earlier in a previous tape of how the general eventually persuaded the two sides to withdraw 15 kilometres at
yes.
a time. And this generally quietened the situation, which was already fairly quiet as far as you were concerned.
Yes.
What happened after that?
Well, it did just that. It did this business like until they got to here, when they were out of the disputed area. And I forget, we stood by... for a long time, I mean something like a year, waiting for the Council of Ambassadors, whoever they were, who were apparently ruling the world at that time from Paris, to decide what was to be done with Upper Silesia. And the end of this year, as you probably know, they came out with a solution to draw a frontier bang through the middle of the Industriegebiet, the industrial area of Upper Silesia, right through the mining area, you know, where there's all this bother going on now. And, of course, it was a ridiculous frontier, because, as I say, it went straight through the mining area. It might have been one side or the other, but it wasn't. I suppose they thought they were being very fair doing that. Anyway, they did that.
Now, at the time, did you see this as a faintly ridiculous solution?
Oh, I think so, yes. But it didn't... I mean, who were we? I mean, we were soldiers and we were going to go. And, of course, we did go. I mean, as soon as that had been done, I imagine the Poles probably walked into their bit of it. The Germans more or less withdrew from their bit. And we all went back to our native lands.
Now, this withdrawal, I mean, that was quite an interesting process from an article you wrote. Could you run through how it was organised? Because it's always difficult to hand over power in an area. What happened exactly?
Well, I don't know firsthand, you see, because I was out in the blue in some place. I knew this was going on, that the British troops would... the Polish troops or whoever they were in Germany would literally go back by 15 kilometres, and then as soon as it was established that that had been done, the other people went back 15 kilometres.
No, this is, I mean, at the end of the final period, when the Germans were coming in to take over
their
part.
Oh, when the Germans were coming in.
For instance, what happened when you'd been in this house at Tarawa, and they'd also occupied a Schloss at Gross Strelitz.
Yes.
What happened when you had to hand those houses back? I mean, what arrangements were made? Did you have to pay compensation, that sort of thing?
There was I didn't know much about it, but there was a sort of little tiny commission on damage done to these places. And for some odd reason, I and A and other were told to run this for the Gross Strelitz Schloss, I think. But anyhow, both sides were told to put in a claim for damage to their properties. The Germans put in the most remarkable document. I only wish I still had it, and I gave it to somebody in Germany, down to things like 2 square meters of turf on the tennis court destroyed by the actions of British dogs. That kind of thing. Proper German document. At any rate, they both put in these damage claims, and I, for some odd reason, and somebody else, were told to adjudicate on this. Well, we simply said 50-50. We weren't going to have to pay for it. The German government and the Polish government would have to pay for it. So we just said 50-50, and they pay. And that's exactly what happened.
So,
but a tremendous amount of documentation. And I stupidly sent that thing back to somebody in opposition. It's gone now.
Now, in your article, you said that the day before the Allies left, there was a gap in control between the Allies being in charge and the Germans being in charge, and that there was some trouble with people paying off old scores against women who'd consorted with the British. Could you tell me about that? That was quite interesting.
Well, there was just this one day. We're actually getting into trains and so on, but they'd given up control, and the German and Polish governments were taking over the parts that had been allotted to them. As an individual, I was in Oppeln, which was in the German bit, and there's that little story about Lady Henniker's dress and so on.
I'll come to that. Could you just, if we stick to the bit about the bullying of civilians who...
Well, that's what this is really about, you see, because Oppeln, I think it was on the particular day when the trains taking the British and the French and possibly the Italian high commissioners and generals and so on away, all went from Oppeln. And they went either that day or the next day, it doesn't matter which, were sort of dies non, when nobody was in control. And, yes, on the day the generals went away, nobody was in control. The general went off in his train, the British general, and the others did the same. And people like me went off in another train a bit later, on the same day. And that's just that gave rise to this little story about Lady Henniker's dress, which is, I think, is in that thing. And that's where...
Could you tell that story?
Well, just as they were going to go, Lady Henniker suddenly remembered she'd left a dress with a dressmaker somewhere at the other side of Oppeln town. And how was she going to get that back? And up spoke FWSJ and said, Lady Henniker, I will do it. You see, and I said, I'll go. Well, I rather wanted to see what was happening. That was the motive. So we had a German car, apart from the British Army staff cars, we had a German car with a German chauffeur, which used to take the general about. That car and that chauffeur were still there. So I said to this chap, I want you to take me to the other side of the town because we left some documents there. And the chap said, yes, I'll do that, sir. If you don't mind my taking this Union Jack off the front, I said, certainly I don't mind taking the Union Jack off the front. So off we went. The general's train was still in the station waiting, you see. And I went off to get these alleged documents, which of course was her dress from a dressmaker's. And I think it's all in this story. the last lap of the journey, it wasn't any great distance, was about half the German army in uniform waiting to come in and take over. So I didn't quite know what they did about that. And every time I thought, oh, in for a penny, in for a pound, I went up and did the thing I'd never done before and saluted a German officer and said, "We have left some documents behind. Do you mind if I go through here and get them?" And he said, "Oh, no, that's all right, Herr Oberleutnant. Don't you go and get them, you see." So I went and got the dress from the dressmakers and came back to the same picket or whatever it was. And the chap was very civil. We saluted each other again, I think. And his orderly or soldier who was with him said to his officer, "Do you mind if I go down with the British officer to the station to see the British generals go?" That shook him a bit, but he said yes. I said, "Right, he'll come along with me," and that's the end of that story. He came down to the station with permission of his officer to see the British generals go, and a good time was had by all. And then Lady Henniker got her dress back, and the Anglo-German relations were quite normal. Now, to say they were cold.
At this period, you also, I believe, saw some youths attacking a German girl.
Well, that was a bit later, in the same day. I was still, I don't know why, but I was not going then. I mean, I was going the next day or something like that. And a place called the Forms Hotel, I suddenly saw anything might happen on that day because nobody was actually, I think, legally the sovereign power. Anyway, I saw about 20 German youths marching a wench down the street with nothing on. And it very soon became apparent they were marching her down to do her no good because she'd been going out with British troops. So I thought A ought to do something about that, but A had no standing there. So it so happened, as I put in that thing, that an old pre-occupation German policeman was wandering about. You know, they had these sort of town policemen, old chaps wearing a purple frock coat and carrying a sword and that sort of thing, long before we ever went there. Anyway, he'd come to life. So I saw this chap and I said, "Look, you see that girl over there? You go and arrest her and put her in the town hall, and don't you release her until I say so." And of course, being good Germans, they knew the voice of an officer when they heard one, and he went and did just that. As far as I know, she's still there. But that was sort of part of the comic opera. This old gentleman in a purple frock coat, there was nothing unusual in purple frock coats. The station master, Gross Strelitz, had another one. And I think he had a sword, too, because he went to the Great Queen's funeral. It's all like that. It was.
Were there any other incidents of that sort?
I don't think so. And I don't like people inclined to invent things, but anything I've said did actually happen, including that little bit about the girl. And this old chap, with his sword and cocked hat or what it was, literally arrested her and I think put her in the town hall jug and probably saved her life.
Now, that same day you left, a little later, did you?
I think so, yes. Another train brought up later on. I think it was the same day.
Were you sorry to leave?
Oh, yes, the idea of going back to conventional soldiering wasn't very pleasant. But I went, actually, everything was in a state of flux. My regiment was being disbanded, you see, at that time. The Irish regiments were being disbanded.
This was because of the situation in Ireland?
In Ireland. Ireland had become independent, you see, and therefore, logically, all the Irish regiments could no longer be part of the British Army. And so we were being disbanded, and I went back from Upper Silesia to Cologne, and I was sort of, I can't quite remember how it came about, but I was attached to Rhine Army signals. You see, I knew we were being disbanded. I also knew very well that I did not want to go to somebody else's regiment.
Why was that?
Well, I was a fairly senior subaltern for a start. Well, a senior subaltern is not going to be popular in anybody's regiment vis-a-vis the other subalterns coming in from outside. And whatever I wanted and so forth didn't matter very much. What did happen was you were told you could put in for three regiments. They didn't guarantee to give you any. I didn't put in for any. But at that time, the Corps signals was about being given birth to and separated from the Royal Engineers. And I had been doing signalling most of my time in the Army. I thought this might be a break, go to something that is fairly new. So